Hi, and welcome to Inference, an AI business podcast by Silo AI. I'm Ville Holkko, co-founder of Silo, the largest private AI lab in the Nordics that focuses on building human-centric AI for businesses. With the Inference podcast, we introduce a number of topics and people of the global AI scene that every business decision maker should know. With me today is Mr. Mark Dillon. Mark is the CTO of Basemark, a company specializing in benchmarks, processing engines, as well as consultancy, used by some of the leading automotive and semiconductor companies in the world. Today, we're going to be discussing about the art and science of building AI products and teams. Now, Mark has made quite a path for himself in the world of tech. After launching his career at Nokia, Mark took the global spotlight as the co-founder and figurehead of Yolla, a Nokia spin-off that sought to challenge the telephone giants with the new cellular platform, the Sailfish. After Yolla, Mark held a number of executive roles in Asmo Solutions, a hardware company, as well as Zen Robotics, a renowned AI and automation developer. In March 2020, Mark took on the role of CTO at Basemark. Mark, it's truly a pleasure to have you. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ville. Thank you.
So after giving your introduction, I think it would be lovely if you could reiterate upon that. So I'd love to hear you introduce yourself a little bit and tell us about your background.
Cool. Thank you. It's funny. I just had Apple as a customer for the first time, and I told them, well, I've been an Apple user for more than 40 years now. Being 48 years old. So my father put a computer in my hands, an Apple II Plus, when I was 7 years old. And I learned structured programming shortly thereafter because I was interested in music, and the only way to write music on the Apple was to basically create code that oscillates at different frequencies. So I would create a little block of code, and that would be a C note or a D note or something. And I would take my aunt's sheet music and write little programs to try to impress the family with that, look, I can make music too. Mm. As a teenager, I thought I was going to be a rock star. I was a guitar player, and I thought that my career would be in music. And at 18, I got a job at a wireless company doing data entry, and they had a computer crash, and I looked at them and said, well, we're typing things from one computer into another. You know, these computers can talk to each other. So I made a null modem cable and plugged in a couple of computers and started a career in wireless, which now I'm on my 30th year coming up on. Mm. And I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of the best people in the industry, both in terms of creating mobile devices, creating the operating systems for mobile devices, creating the infrastructure and backends for mobile devices. And then for the last 4 or 5 years, I've gotten an opportunity to work in more high-tech and bleeding-edge things than even mobile was able to provide. And now I was looking for a company that, you know, I have been an entrepreneur and I have worked in various capacities in big and small companies, and I wanted to find a company that had a very good customer base that was not looking necessarily or was not needing to have investment money in order to survive, had good cash flow. And I found Basemark. Yeah. And it also happened to bring in some of the world-leading bleeding-edge technology, getting into automotive, autonomous drive, high-end graphics and compute solutions. So, so it was really cool to it was kind of a twist of fate. Actually, you and I were sitting together in a restaurant when an old colleague walked up who was working at Basemark and said, hey, we're looking for a CTO. And I never thought I'd be a CTO. I'm kind of a chief operating officer a lot of the time, where I liked to be the right hand of a CEO or of a visionary or an entrepreneur and help them build the company that they want by taking people, connecting them to customers, and then releasing relentlessly products towards the customers, getting feedback, and then being able to use this in order to build a product that many customers would then be able to buy.
Yeah.
So this is kind of the interesting thing about the topic of this podcast is a lot of people say, show me the team when they're looking at a company to invest in or looking at reasons to go to a company. For me, it's like, show me a customer, and then we can build a team to address that customer.
Yeah.
And then you talk to one customer and you might not know what you're talking about because they know their industry better than you do.
Mm.
You talk to two or more customers, then all of a sudden you become the center of information.
Yeah.
And then you become the wisest one of them all. And if you're relentlessly releasing product towards a customer, towards more than one customer, then you get the opportunity to build something that's great for many.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually really interesting how small the world is, like referencing to kind of the way you got onboarded with Basemark before is also, you know, the connection between Basemark and Silo is very strong at the moment because we've been collaborating a lot with some of the automotive work that has been happening out there. But tell us a little bit more about Basemark. What is it that you guys actually do?
Basemark has been around for about 5 years. It was a spinoff from a company called Rightware. The kind of the genesis of Basemark was in the benchmarking business, which is really interesting because you build a set of benchmarks that they then become a standard if they are used.
Yeah.
And we have become a standard in the GPU testing domain, and we are used by many manufacturers in order to test and compare how does their new chip compare to what else is on the market today. Along the way, we also have a services business that has been doing autonomous drive and automotive and human machine interfaces, HMI. And we have built a graphics engine called Rock Solid, which is tailored towards embedded applications. So embedded means that instead of having a computer with variable resources and a big hard drive that it can start caching things out to, embedded means you allocate all of your memory at the beginning and you have a very small footprint and you're very conscious of how much processing time you're using, maybe how much battery you're using in an automotive application, how much electricity are you using, because electricity also equals heat. So we have an embedded graphics engine. And interesting thing about the graphics processing business in general, I like to compare for lay people GPUs and CPUs. And I say it's very, very simple. A CPU is can only do one thing at a time, so it's male. It doesn't multitask. GPUs can do many things at one time, so it's a bit more female, can do many things at once. So what people learned is that they can use GPUs instead for processing graphics. They can use it for processing something like AI because you can run many things in parallel.
Yeah.
So we are taking our graphics engine, which is very efficient and good for embedded applications, and building these computing functionalities into it so that inside the vehicle we can run, do the edge processing for AI, which means the stuff that is actually looking around at all of the different sensors on the car and understanding, are there pedestrians coming? Do we need to brake? Is this full autonomous drive where we're looking at the road and the GPS and the map data and what's coming from the LiDAR, the laser radar, what's coming from the cameras and all the other systems, and then running that through this processing engine to basically render all of that as one big vision of where the car is and what is moving around the car. So Basemark is in this very interesting position where we create benchmarks, which are used by processor companies. They optimize towards our libraries, which are, because this is a public standard benchmark, they optimize towards our libraries, which are also things that we then turn around and productize for solutions that are built upon those processors. So there's a bit of a circular economy in what we do.
That's really interesting. And let's talk about your points of views for the AI product industry right now. Because as we start to discuss about the nature of AI products, you can't really have that discussion without addressing some of the hype and kind of the conceptions that there have been in the emergence of AI on this technical level, especially the deeper you go into the core technology and AI and the commercialization side of that. I think the more surprising you'll be to discover some of the key figures that are happening in that space. But I'd love to get your points of views into actually implementing AI as a part of a product. Because if we look at your history at Zen Robotics, you've been at the center of actually implementing AI as a part of the core technology stack of a new business. Mm-hmm. Now at Basemark, you could even say that you're on the enabling side of AI. So you guys are building the, you know, the platforms, you're building the toolkits which enable other people to build AI into their products with. Mm-hmm. So what's your point of view right now? Where are we with the level of AI that is being integrated into the productions, or, for example, the clients of your company?
That's a really interesting question. One of the things, people think that AI is a silver bullet and is capable of many different things. And one of the things that people talk about a lot with AI is the ability to do things that are not necessarily standard. So if we look at Zen Robotics, it's sorting waste. Yeah. Anything can come down a waste belt. Just think about what you put in your garbage. Mm. And we want to pull out the right things and put them into places when they might be in many kinds of different configurations. You know, if we're sorting bottles, for example, sometimes they're smashed. Sometimes the labels are taken off of them. Sometimes a brand new color shows up. You know, all these kinds of things. But in general, the state of AI today, from my humble opinion, is it works better when the rules are clear. So if we are sorting only plastic bottles, which are of a certain type, and we're removing trash from that, removing things that are not those bottles, that's pretty clear rules.
Yeah.
If we're building autonomous vehicles, we all want, you know, the, well, maybe we don't all. I have an old gasoline-powered sports car, so maybe not. But if we're all looking forward towards autonomous driving vehicles because they're safer and they're cleaner and they're better for the environment and maybe even more convenient, then we have to stop and think that if it is in a controlled environment, then there's a much faster opportunity to get to market than trying to deal with every single situation that a vehicle might find on the road.
Yeah.
So the example that I like to use here is in airport shuttles. So if there is an airport shuttle that takes you from your terminal to the parking, there's a completely closed loop. We understand that, yes, there might be pedestrians in certain places. Yes, there might be vehicles or buses in certain places. But the basic map isn't changing. It's very well controlled. There's not going to be spontaneous construction or spontaneous changes in the road or the layout or the buildings or something. So we all know that full autonomous driving vehicles will be here someday.
Yeah.
And I think taking the path towards, let's just say it's not going to work in every situation, but let's make some situations that work really well.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. Like I kind of call for, you know, Helsinki has been talking about being one of the greatest cities in the world for public transportation and getting vehicles out of the center of the city. So this is an initiative that's been going on for a while. So what if Helsinki said, let's be a place where the only vehicles in town are autonomous driving vehicles and optimize the city for this purpose?
Yeah.
What does that mean? Does it mean setting up some kind of sensor tags? Does it mean changing the way that the bicycle lanes or the pedestrian lanes would flow, or just, you know, making a collective effort towards doing something like this? I could see this happen in some kind of cities in the future. I can see it happening in, you know, we're already doing this. AI is working in material handling in lots of different places. You know, Amazon's warehouses, for example, things like this. It's still a relatively closed environment. I would like to see where these predictable environments and public spaces start to merge first, because I don't have the feeling today that when I look at the AI capabilities I've been exposed to that we're going to the wild open road yet. But, you know, then there's the other kind of side of the coin, which is that what if we start on the big scale that, you know, autopilot was one of the first autonomous driving things to come, and it's basically a little bit more than adaptive cruise control. So it could be that the bigger highway systems are the first places that this kind of thing gets productized. So that's really, really interesting things. And there's a tremendous amount of investment in this area. There's a tremendous amount of people working on the problem. And they're doing a lot of really interesting work, but I think a lot of it's still in the simulation levels today. And we're reaching at moonshots, and nobody has, I think, the full path to the moon yet.
That, it's a really interesting point of view to take, and kind of riding that wave, what you're bringing to the table is kind of the ideology of holistic product design with AI at its core, right?
Yes.
And I think, you know, one of the misconceptions that has started to change lately is the fact that we need to design a new product or a new system. Sure, the AI engine needs to be at the core, but a lot of things have to happen around that.
Yes.
And arguably, preparing the environment and preparing the whole, you know, other setup into that tiny, tiny fraction-sized AI component inside is what truly separates the successful products from the perhaps more painful paths, if you will. So if you take autonomous driving as an example, it's actually a funny concept because we associate autonomous driving with AI. Those are almost two synonymous terms. But if you drill down to it, it's not machine learning that drives the car. It's machine learning that grinds down the sensor feed, that recognizes pedestrians, that recognizes drivable surfaces. But that small piece of machine learning, or many pieces of machine learning, are surrounded by bounding boxes, if you will, rules and set systems that tell the system, you know what it can do and what it cannot do. AI is a tiny piece of that. And the much more important question is, sure, okay, if we want to build a product around this tiny AI component, how do we need to prepare the world or the rest of the product to match that algorithm?
Yes.
But it's also nice to see that kind of also the, in the, because Basemark also does consultancy, just like Silo. So I think, you know, one of the differences that we've seen, and probably you guys as well, is kind of the change in the mindset of the buyer itself. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in 2015, 2016, the first mindset was, can we buy an AI to automate our customer service? And now a couple of years later, we're actually, you know, running toward the point where we're starting to ask the question, okay, can we get a piece of machine learning to automate intent recognition of incoming customer service queries that we can then build a less intelligent system to kind of handle those pre-qualified things. So the mindset of what is an AI product has changed fundamentally. And I think with that, you know, the composition of teams have to change as well, because, you know, before we were thinking about how, what do we need to build an AI product? Well, we need AI scientists and we need AI engineers, right? Now we're starting to move into the world where we need designers, where we need design thinking, where we need back-end engineering and so forth. So how has it been for you guys? Have you started to adapt your team compositions or the way that you approach, you know, kind of the AI capabilities versus the rest of the capabilities in terms of design or back-end development skills? Or do you see that in the client side, in the demand of it?
You hit on a really interesting thing here, which is why service business? And why service business is because at the beginning of a project, at the prototyping stage of a product, which may be a whole entire phase, you know, Fred Brooks in The Mythical Man Month said, build a system to throw away because you will anyway. He also said, beware of the second system syndrome, which is you try to solve everything there, which wasn't the point. But prototyping phase, and then in the development phase, the testing along with that, certifications, all of these things, they require many different disciplines. So for a company to hire people for only one of those phases and then, you know, have to, how do you handle all of the others? Do you hire people that are only going to be used for, if you have a three-year project, for the first 6 months of that project, or the first 18 months, or the last 18 months? So services business for any large-scale project, and even small ones, is interesting because you can keep the best people in the world for the part of work that's most relevant today.
Yes.
And that's really interesting. So then one of the things that I've seen a lot in this kind of business as well is where we build up really high functional prototypes using whatever we can get, open source tools, whatever stacks and data sets can be gotten. Connect two points, the furthest two points that we can together as quickly as we can, see what we've learned from it, and then document that architecture and then start to build hard, certifiable, clean architectural components to fulfill what we learned in the prototyping. And this is two very, very different skill sets. And the interesting thing is that so many of these things, like if we think about autonomous drive, this is aerospace level of certification, which means that if you have written it so clearly in a waterfall fashion that you you understand it well enough to go build it, how long it took to specify is now ages in terms of what the technology has done. If it takes you 18 months to specify something to, that you're going to then go spend a few years to build, by the time you started building it, the technology has moved on, and so have your competitors. So there's these, there's a lot of really interesting trade-offs here where perhaps the specification is not all done up front. It is done in conjunction with rapid prototyping. This is then resulting in real-world ground truth specification based upon a working prototype system that then can get quickly rolled into production systems. So there's a lot of ground there that service business can be much more agile. That's not a very good word anymore, but can be much more responsive to the current need. Perhaps is a better way to look.
Fair enough.
And by the way, there's nothing, since we're using dirty words, there's nothing more lean than service business, because, you know, lean is about build things that somebody's willing to pay for.
Fair enough. I buy that. Buy that. And kind of to follow up with the kind of the paradox of specifications here, because, you know, in the context of autonomy, you need to go through it. But then on the other hand, as you spend time to do it, I think the requirements are also evolving and adapting at the same time.
Yes.
And another layer of the specifications, I think, that has been historically touched less upon is kind of the front end specifications, the need for the design, the need for the human machine interfacing, because it's one of the things that you guys, you know, as well, are encountering in your business, the HMI. And we do too, because you can't really separate AI and design from one another anymore these days. Because by definition, most machine learning systems demand a human counterpart as an operator. It doesn't matter if it's customer service, if it's autonomous driving, whatever the system is that you're looking to automate, most likely there is a human in the loop. And if there is one, most likely the success of your AI project is highly dependent on the quality of your design, right? Because let's assume that if you build and design a beautiful, highly sophisticated AI tool that does document indexing or key phrase detection and pinpointing, and the tool is crap, what will end up happening is that the AI starts to make prediction, the operator will start to use the system. Eventually, they will get frustrated, they will start to abandon the system or find other workarounds to get into that same goal. And once that happens, the annotations stop and the learning stop. And the whole intricate system, the whole beautiful engine that you build is basically worthless, because there's no relearning taking place because your design was dysfunctional. And I suppose this is something that you guys are seeing as well, because, you know, HMI, human machine interfacing, is one of the big things that you're focusing on, especially in autonomous driving.
Oh, you opened up a lot of cans of worms there. So to answer your question, yes. Looking at this a little bit differently, if we start a design based upon what the human sees and feels and interacts with, that's a good starting point, because a lot of what we're talking about is kind of abstract.
Mm.
If we talk about all these different sensor inputs and bounding boxes and things like this.
Mm.
Of course, something that you do in AI development is you do a lot of data visualization, which then allows humans to understand what is the machine seeing, what is it thinking, what it's doing.
Yeah.
How you share those with humans is really important. There's so many simple things here that people don't necessarily take into account. Talk is cheap, so let's do more of it.
Mm.
People don't really understand often what they want, but if you show them something, they can tell you if that's it or not.
Mm.
So often, you know, talking to customers about what they want or what they're looking for versus showing them one thing or showing them options. You like it like this or you like it like that.
Mm.
There's so many things with regards to HMI, human-machine interfaces. Then within a vehicle, we have lots of different screens, and 7 is a really common number, where you might have several in the dashboard, you might have augmented reality rear-view mirrors, and then you might have in-vehicle infotainment in the back seats, and you have screens all over the place. And how everybody interacts with every one of those, how the machine inside, it's like how many screens you have in your house. It's like if you take the phones, you know, out of the equation, ones that are actually hooked to the wires, not that many anymore.
Mm.
And now we're talking about a car with 7 of them. So does your little computer that you have on the desk, can you imagine that serving 7 screens? So there's a lot of different things with regards to HMI that they come into play for us. One thing that's been really key as well is how do you inform a driver of a motor vehicle without distracting them?
Yeah.
How do you only give them relevant information without information that they're going to look at for a second too long, and then they haven't noticed that it meant you need to stop now because there's a truck in front of you or thing. You know, there's so many of these kind of things that, it takes iteration and it takes a lot of this pre kind of testing work.
Mm.
It takes a lot of prototyping, and with a lot of these, you may have brilliant designers, and those designers, they do a bunch of different, they have their own techniques of doing study and understanding, and they have their experience, and they have, you know, all the work that they've done before that they bring to the table. But then until we put it in front of many different kind of people, we don't understand how they're going to interpret it.
Yes.
You know, if there's anything that, like, doing performance or speaking like this has told me, it's like the feedback is never about the parts you thought it was going to be.
Mm.
But yeah, thinking about design and how the human interacts, how the human is advised. Are there traffic lights telling them something is good or something is not good, or be careful about something? Is there lots of different kinds of telltales that can give somebody an understanding that the vehicle is thinking for me, but it's not overriding my thoughts. It's not, you know, AI has all these kind of components. I'm trying to kind of crystallize a vision for you.
Yeah.
But it's like if we start from how the human interacts, then we can give them a lot more confidence that the machine is not doing things they don't want.
Yes. We're discussing about AI, and I suppose the corny thing is AI is all about prediction, so I'd love to get yours. So, as a finisher, before we end, I'd love to get your prediction over the past next 24 to 48 months. What's going to be the next big thing that we're going to be seeing in the world of AI products, especially, you know, in the field that you guys are working on? Is it going to be happening on the algorithmic side or kind of the technological innovations? Or is it a more kind of a human reformation that we're going to be seeing, kind of the democratization of the basic AI skills and how those are being brought back into the everyday work? So what's your prediction, Mark, for the next 24 to 48 months in AI products?
24 to 48 months. There could be good news and there could be bad news.
Mm.
I was debating in my head whether or not I take this track, but
yeah.
The good news could be that we see a lot of We see a lot of tasks where we are able to help people at levels that we have not before. Autonomous driving will start to be coming up much more strongly, and you will have fewer accidents on the road. Using AI in healthcare, we used to say that, well, the more educated you are, then the safer you are when the robots come. And then we find things like, well, doctors and patient diagnosis is like a huge field where we may be healthier because, you know, we prefer to go to an old doctor because they have a lot of experience. Well, AI might bring all the experience of all the doctors ever, you know, to within minutes of you. The bad news would be we end up in a world where we have AI that has been taken to market in critical applications too quickly, that we end up with either arguing with machines or machines getting in the way of us trying to accomplish the things that we want.
Yeah.
So I think we'll see more of the good news than the bad, but you know, there's one of the things, people are afraid of what the AI is capable of, and it's not the AI to be afraid of, it's the people that created it.
True enough. All right, with that, Mark, I thank you. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure.